Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew. And a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's May the 23rd, 2013. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, I think I'll weight this podcast down a bit towards the beginning. Now, the first thing I want to do is give a shout-out to some of our new comrades and listeners down in Oregon, where things are definitely starting to look up. Because of our unpleasant neighbors listening over the fence, I need to be discreet about names, so all you new guys in Grants Pass, Salem, Bend, and Portland, welcome home, and welcome to the first day of the rest of our people's life. I'd also like to give a shout-out to a couple of newbies in Great Falls and Billings, Montana, and here in our own state capital of Olympia. Welcome home, comrades. Now, as you may have gathered, despite my gloom and doom on occasion, who, me, things are in fact starting to come together at the speed of an O.J. Simpson car chase. Now, I have to be very circumspect here because this week I have, in fact, had pointed out to me two specific groups of hostiles who are listening to these podcasts and trying to use the contents against us. Surprise, surprise, Sergeant Carter! But on the other hand, I know it does get depressing after a while when people don't know what's going on and they think there's no forward motion at all. There is. But with a few exceptions, like the Portland literature distributions, they're mostly things that, number one, you would have to be more involved to understand and appreciate their significance, and number two, I shouldn't be talking about in public in any case. Suffice it to say that there has always been a plan within the plan, so to speak, and it's finally starting to come together. Now, one thing I can mention, since it's been discussed on Northwest Revolution already, is that we have several volunteer artists who are beginning to work on the first Northwest Front graphic novels or comic books or comic strips, and I'll be interested to see what they come up with. But all that having been said, I still have the same moan about it all, and that is that it's moving too damn slow. Slow as molasses in wintertime, and we may not have the time for that. Now, like I said several weeks ago, it may well be that the balloon is never going to go up at all, that we're just in for year after year of long, slow decline into a third world one-party Marxist state, but then again, I could be wrong. A Benny could freak out and attack Iran tomorrow, or people could wake up and realize that we've got a nigger in the White House. Anything could happen. So we need to be in at least some semblance of readiness in case something does break. We're at one of those weird junctures in history where literally anything, good or bad, might happen. You've got a double-decker bus balanced on a bowling pin here. Now, the one thing that is absolutely necessary for us to speed things up is to break the mainstream media blackout. Last week's stats for NorthwestFront.org were screwed up by the 10-hour outage we had, and there have been several shorter periods of downtime since, so it's hard to judge if we're going to be able to keep on breaking 6,000 hits per week. But even if we do, that's still nowhere the viewership that we need to break out of our silly little movement bubble and break into a presence in the Northwest white community itself. Now, I'll tell you who is definitely not happy about the NF's continued slow progress, and that's the small group of three or four individuals who have been pursuing me across the internet for the past few years like the Hound of the Baskervilles, either for money or because they're cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, or both. I referred to them in my special February 21st podcast, so I won't go over this in detail again. You can listen to the February 21st show if you missed it. But this is a new development, which I frankly find funny. These morons post heckling comments every week to the Thought Crime and Homeland blogs, which I never approve and seldom even finish reading. Usually, they don't have anything to say, at least nothing I haven't heard before, and it's not worth hearing to begin with. And once I realize what it is and who sent it, I just click on the mouse and blow it away. But I've been reading them and chuckling over them for the past week because they've actually gotten pretty funny. Now, have you ever seen and heard an enraged 2-year-old screaming and hollering at the top of his lungs and holding his breath until he turns blue and beating his little fisties on the wall in a major tantrum? That's what this last week reminds me of. Now, I'm not sure exactly what or why, but something I said on last week's podcast seems to have set these idiots off like howler monkeys. Then, of course, several days ago, I uploaded the Joseph Stack video to YouTube. And that seems to have driven at least one of these 3 or 4 weirdos completely around the twist, because I've been bombarded with dozens of abusive comments. Different IP addresses from the persona management software proxy servers are using to try and hide, but the same boilerplate script. And these latest posts really cross the line into outright hysteria and mentally ill frenzy. However, it has been pointed out to me that the same boilerplate text has been appearing on a number of forums under different names and IP addresses, presumably again using persona management software, which I understand is now on the open market, by the way, and you can just buy it along with Cass Sunstein and the FBI if you really want to waste your time infiltrating Facebook with up to 16 different fake IDs. Well, if you're a Facebook addict, that's one way to make sure Zuckerberg's Moroccans never throw you off. That's where his main tech support site is, apparently Morocco. Where was I? Oh, yeah. Guys, I get that you're trying to disguise yourselves as this big internet army in order to insert smears and crap about me into our wee little narrative that nobody cares about, but I don't see much point in using a different name and hiding your IP address if you're going to post the same scripted bullshit off the same template. In most cases, literally word for word. You guys must be just cutting and pasting. That kind of gives the game away. Now, normally I would never reply to these people's horse manure, and I know I'm just feeding their lust for contact in their weird stalkers' minds, but part of their scripted attack brings up something that it is possible might in the future be used against me and my work in a more serious context by a much more serious opponent. Now, this is the allegation that my Joseph Stack video and my repeated admonitions against proactive and direct action for actual change on the part of individuals, that it's some kind of scam. Or alternatively, I am a quote-unquote hypocrite because I urge you people against committing direct acts to create actual change outside any serious political context, while all the time I'm supposed to be making oodles and oodles of money from my novels about violence. Now, that's another one of the more bizarre rumors that's been going around lately, that I'm supposed to be getting rich off my books. No. Oh, and I'm also supposed to be a quote-unquote coward because I will not lead my little revolution out here by strapping a dynamite vest on myself and going out and blowing myself up in a KFC or something. Now, like I said, normally I wouldn't respond to this kind of goat droppings from goat dancers, but there is a good chance that this is going to come up in a more serious context in the future, so let me spell this out clearly so there's no misunderstanding. I made that Joseph Stack video because I really, really don't want any of you going berserk with a semi-auto or doing anything else stupid and suicidal. Really, I don't. Yes, it's true that one of the reasons I would rather you didn't do anything dumb like that is so that I won't have to spend 2 years in a courtroom with Mark Potok trying to prove to a jury full of niggers and knuckleheads that I didn't sit here in my secret bunker and send you hypnotic thought waves taking over your brain, commanding you to kill my pretty. Kill! Kill! Don't laugh. They tried to claim Matt Hale did just that with Ben Smith back in 99. But the main reason I had that video made is that I don't want anybody to die for nothing. When the time comes for us to act and to die for what is right, as I very much fear it will, we need to trade our lives for change and for a new world where we can secure the existence of our people and the future for white children. I don't particularly care about all this other horse dung these goat dancing fools put out about me. I know it's not true, and I just can't be worried about people who are so bird-brained stupid that they take it seriously. But the one thing I never, ever want to be said about me, true or false, is that I threw away a white life for nothing. I will never do so, and I don't want any of you doing it either. Watch that Joe Stack video again and heed what I say. We will not win this by dying for our country. We will win it someday by making these other dumb bastards die for their country or for their sick vision of it.
Good evening, comrades. This week, I'm reviewing a book by Bill White called The Centuries of Revolution. This book is a synopsis on world history, and it talks about how the Jewish people have become very prominent on the world stage. Bill White is attempting here to trace their origin all the way from ancient times, and he believes that the root race of the Jewish people were a group called the Chandala, which was a very low caste that was known to the Vedic Indians. And this was a caste that would dispose of bodies, and they did a lot of jobs that no one else wanted to do. And this was a group of people that tended to, over time, worship various deities that were associated with chaos. And he says that they left Egypt in order to worship various deities that lived in the wilderness. And over time, this sort of hodgepodge of deities became known as Jove or Yahweh, although there were some more peaceful sub-religions that came up, such as the worship of the golden calf, which was largely put down. And over time, another group became Jewish, and these were the Khazars. Really, initially, these people had no relationship to the original Jews. But I'm sure in the United States and Israel, I'm sure there's been a lot of intermarriage by this point. Now, this group was always interested in rearranging society. And what happened in Europe was that you had all the upheaval of the Napoleonic Wars. Prior to Napoleon, you had all these small European states where often ethnic groups were divided into these little states. And so all these little states had some Jewish people in them, but they were kind of separated from each other. And then as nations got larger in Europe, you had Jewish groups that could interact more readily. So this theory goes. And they started to consolidate their power. And he talks about how they influenced a lot of historical events. He says that the Civil War, for instance, was really the Scots-Irish against the Jewish-British banking system. And he says that the Jewish people were always making sure that the South ran short of all the supplies that it needed. And the American Jews didn't really have an aristocracy to attack. But they could make white people start to hate themselves. And he talks about during the 50s, for example, how a lot of the freedom riders that went down south were actually Jewish. And it's interesting how he says the Jews were against the aristocracy and or against whites, because, of course, when you look at the root word of aristocracy, it's very much like the word Arisch, which is German for Aryan. So that's sort of an interesting observation. Now, one of the things that we see as the modern world came about, start to see more and more of the primitive. And, for example, we see this in the art of Picasso. He was very influenced by African art. And he also talks a lot about Boaz and how, of course, Boaz spoke against any belief in race and how, for instance, Einstein stole a great deal from his Serbian wife and also assistants, according to Bill White. And he sees problems everywhere. He says that Cecil Rhodes, for example, was advocating limited self-rule, and even that was problematic because at least it sort of gave an idea of self-rule and encouraged actual self-rule later on. He also even criticizes the Irish Republican Army because he said that was led by proto-communist Jews and distorted notions of Celtic pride. And he sees World War I as a conflict of monarchy on racial grounds by revolutionaries who wanted to really destroy Europe. He says that the problem with Germany after the First World War was that the Kaiser did not understand the danger of Lenin, and so Lenin gets sent back to Russia to create revolution there, and talks about a Jewish role in Versailles through someone by the name of Ludwig von Mises. And even though that doesn't sound like a Jewish name at all, claims that he was also Jewish. And about how Germany was always in the middle of communist and capitalist struggles. He says that many people in modern times are deceived by the myths of progress and talks about spiritual life as a life that is above time and a life in the world as a life that is in time. And he talks about Hitler as being a man against time who found ways to strengthen Germany financially by canceling things like mortgage debts and foreclosures. And that, yes, he was for eugenics. And yes, some people are turned off by that, but there's more to life than mere existence. And he reminds people in the movement that he was also very much against alcoholism. So people in the movement that are getting them drunk all the time should remember that alcoholics were sterilized under eugenics programs. He says that Hitler was not against Britain. He really, he felt that Germany could rule alongside Britain, but that he ends up being sort of pushed into the war, and that really the capitalists and the communists are both problematic, and therefore, in a sense, as an avatar, Hitler was ultimately able to fight on two fronts, despite the strategic difficulties of that. Bill White talks about the world today, and he says that many people have sacrificed their souls to dark forces, and that the Aryan is a divine being who is really a minority of whites, but who comes out of the genetic material of the white race. Really talks about a lot of flaws in the movement. Talks about those who think that there is some way to be mainstream and to still make real progress. And he also talks about those who use the movement to socialize. And he's concerned about both these tendencies. But the thing that worries him the most are people in the movement who are obsessed with torture and death, and who join the movement because they believe various stereotypes that they see on television. These people are very harmful to the movement because they perpetuate certain stereotypes, and they also repel sane and healthy people from joining the movement. Because of this problem within the movement, and because of the general degradation of the world, Bill White is very pessimistic about the future. He's really so pessimistic that he really doesn't see the point of even trying anymore. I don't think that Bill White would migrate to the Northwest, for example. because even if he could, he's so pessimistic that he just doesn't see any light at the end of the tunnel. But he says that people who are truly drawn to the movement for the right reasons should be loyal to the movement in order to save their souls, because he really believes that saving your soul is really the only thing that you can save in today's world. So all he sees is God or damn and the end. But he takes no joy in this. He simply believes that nothing can be done at this point. So he's extremely pessimistic and really, like Evola, for example, he wants the end to come so that the new age, the golden age, can return. This is a very, I would call it a very informative book, although I have to say that this author really sees a lot of conspiracies in this book. At times you might think that this is too much. He's seeing too many conspiracies. There couldn't possibly have been so many conspiracies as he's seeing. However, regardless of the details, the end result is still the same. I think it's very interesting to compare this book to the book Aradharma. This, of course, being the much more pessimistic book, and Aradharma being much more optimistic. So they're sort of two views, although they share a lot of ideas. Basically, he says there's essentially two types of people in the world. There's those that have pledged themselves to the dark forces, and there are those who have pledged themselves to the light forces. And even though I don't think anyone remembers what side they chose, because I think it was before they were born, and I don't think there's anyone who remembers this, but there are these two types of people, and right now there are much more people pledged to the dark forces, and there's really nothing you can do about that. So it's a fascinating read, but please understand that it may be depressing. So thank you very much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed my review.
Okay, on to a more cheerful topic. The subject of this week's musical repertoire will be modern anti-Jewish songs, and believe it or not, there are some. I suppose I could start with Frank Zappa's famous rock song, Jewish Princess, but it's a little too raunchy for Radio Free Northwest, so I'll start with this little curiosity item instead. Now, one of the more disgusting Uyghurisms that had developed over the past few years is the phenomenon of white rappers. And normally I wouldn't play any such rubbish on this show, but these two kids managed to rap their way right into the bad books of the Chosen Ones. They call themselves Quincy and Beef. And in December 2009, they were students at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, which is so far left that it has been one of the last preserves of just plain outright Stalinist communism for decades. Anyway, these two dumbass white boys, who probably grew up on South Park and didn't know any better than to talk about Jews in the real world, decided to do a rap song about Jewish girls on campus, and they were damn near crucified. I tried to find out where they ended up, and I can't find any trace of them on the internet, so I suspect they're now officially unpersons. Back in '09, their YouTube video got about 90,000 hits before it was pulled offline. This is called the Coasty Song.
Holla, what's good? What's up, folks? I've been around campus and seen so many fine biddies. What are they wearing, though? I think they look good.
Oh, you're talking about some coasties, aren't you?
Wait, what?
What's a coastie?
Black tights all day.
That's a coastie.
Starbucks, big shade.
She a coastie.
Always blowing daddy's money.
You a coastie.
My East Coast Jewish honey.
What's a coastie? A white tee, V-neck.
That's a coastie.
She always think that she the best.
She a coastie.
American.
princess, baby. Walks with the swag and talks so crazy. East Coast accent, East Coast fashion. Black spandex with an ass like Baskin. Smoking on the cig and she passes. Blurry messaging, multitasking. Take off the glasses, let me see your face. It's a hot summer day, still rocking North Face. Got a Starbucks cup, yeah, you my star bucket. I know you live there, but I can really get you lucky. So I said, honey, be my lady. She said, KK, I'ma meet you with the cake. What's a coasty?
Black tights all day.
That's a coasty.
Starbucks, big shade.
She a coasty.
Always blowing daddy's money.
You a coasty.
My East Coast Jewish honey.
What's a coasty? A white TV neck.
That's a coasty.
She always think that she the best.
She a coasty.
North Face with the other.
You a coasty.
But I'ma still show some love.
Talking on this Sally like, girl, oh God. Coach bag, Gucci shades at the daddy bar. Mugging, wearing V-neck tees with the iPod. Always up in Van Black. I have a question. Baby, sit back, let me explain this lesson.
What's a coasty?
Black tights all day.
That's a coasty.
Starbucks, big shade.
She a coasty.
Always blowing daddy's money.
You a coasty.
My East Coast Jewish honey.
What's a coasty? A white TV neck.
That's a coasty.
She always think that she the best.
She a coasty.
North Face with the
you a coasty.
But I'ma still show some love.
Why the fuck are they even calling me a coasty? And not even from the fucking coast. From Chicago.
What's a coasty?
Black tights all day.
That's a coasty.
Starbucks, big shade.
She a coasty.
Always blowing daddy's money.
You a coasty.
My East Coast Jewish honey.
What's a coasty? A white TV neck.
That's a coasty.
She always think that she the best.
She a coasty.
North Face with the
you a coasty.
But I'ma still show some baby.
What's a coasty?
Coasty.
Coasty.
In June of 2010, North Idaho attorney Edgar J. Steele was arrested by the FBI on false charges of allegedly hiring a hitman to murder his wife and mother-in-law. The alleged assassin was a man named Larry Fairfax, an FBI informer who was inserted into Steele's home posing as a handyman in order to spy on the Steele family until he saw the opportunity to help the Bureau destroy an outspoken critic of the regime. While he was working in the Steele home, Fairfax proceeded to help himself to large stashes of silver coins and bullion the Steeles were keeping on their property in anticipation of a Federal Reserve currency crash brought on by Barack Obama's incompetence. The final whereabouts of that silver seems to be something of a mystery. Apparently, the FBI allowed Fairfax to keep at least some of it as a kind of bonus or reparations for the annoyance and inconvenience of having to spend 16 months in a minimum security prison in the service of the Bureau. The basis of Edgar Steele's conviction were audio files fabricated by FBI technicians, supposedly discussions between himself and Fairfax about murder for hire. These conversations appear even to a layman who first hears them to sound strained, stilted, unnatural, and obviously doctored at the key points and phrases. The Steele tapes were not only forgeries, apparently they weren't even very good ones. At Steele's trial, two international audio engineering experts who were prepared to state categorically for the record that the tapes were fraudulent were barred from testifying by a corrupt judge. The jury was never allowed to hear evidence which clearly proved Edgar Steele's innocence. The situation wasn't helped by the fact that Steele's first attorney, a federal public defender named Roger Peavin, was a raging alcoholic who at the time was being sued by three members of his own legal staff for various acts of drunken misconduct. Steele's second defense attorney, a man named Robert McAllister, on whom he and his wife Cindy expended most of their life savings, turned out to be facing disbarment for embezzling his client's money and was in fact disbarred only weeks after Steele's conviction. Many suspect that this second attorney may have struck a deal with the government to keep himself out of prison by deliberately taking a dive in the courtroom and bungling Steele's defense. If so, it didn't work. In September 2012, the 62-year-old McAllister was sentenced to 6 years for fraud, so there's some comfort in hoping that the bent brief may die in the same prison cell as the client he betrayed. Interestingly enough, McAllister himself was a former United States attorney and prosecutor, which gives you some idea of the typical moral character of the people in the federal judiciary. For whatever reason, McAllister's performance in the courtroom was lackluster, to say the least, and he refused to put his client on the witness stand, which always looks very bad to a jury. Needless to say, the attorney's own perilous legal situation was never explained to either Ed or Cindy Steele while the trial was going on. As icing on the cake, I've spoken to persons present in the courtroom during the trial who told me that Ed Steele, quote-unquote, looked like a zombie, confused and disoriented, and he seemed completely incoherent and disconnected from what was going on around him. The consensus of opinion was that Steele was drugged on orders from someone in the federal government to make sure that he was incapable of assisting in his own defense or even understanding what was happening to him. No one knows for sure why the federal government of the United States did this horrible thing to Edgar Steele. He must have pissed somebody off real bad, although I don't see how. Ed had announced plans to run for governor of Idaho, true, but he subsequently withdrew from the race due to ill health. I have this horrible suspicion that the whole ghastly business may simply have been some kind of grotesque experiment on the part of the FBI simply to see how far they could go and how much they could get away with in arresting and destroying critics of the dictatorship. Edgar Steele is being held, we think, in the Victorville facility, which is well known throughout the federal system as a kind of toilet where human beings are flushed away. Among other things, the water supply in the prison is known to be contaminated with carcinogens and toxic waste, which facilitates the decline in health of those federal prisoners whom the government wishes to hear no more of. Victorville is notorious as an end-of-the-line destination. Once the gates clang shut there, nobody leaves except in a body bag. Edgar Steele has been sent there to die. No one has, in fact, personally heard from Edgar Steele in almost a year now. His mail has been simply disappearing without response. There has been a small amount of information circulated within the white nationalist community to the effect that Edgar is still alive but is being held incommunicado. I have reason to believe that there is more going on than we are being told, but we won't get into that now. Now, the fact is that the prison authorities are completely lacking in credibility, and there is no way to tell what's happened to Ed. Now, he may be in solitary, he may be in the infirmary, he may have been secretly moved to another prison. Or he may be dead from his heart condition or because the dictatorship simply had him murdered in his cell one night. We have no way of knowing. There are other things going on that it would be inadvisable for me to comment on, except to say that it is a matter of great urgency that somehow someone in the outside world needs to reestablish contact with Edgar Steele. Although how this is to be done, I have no idea. Now, I'm going to play for you another excerpt from a podcast that Edgar Steele made on March the 18th, 2010, a little over 10 weeks before the dictator's servants came in the dawn to end his life. They always seem to come at sunrise, by the by. I think someone told them that coming at night was bad optics or whatever. I was listening to this brief excerpt, and I tell you, I felt a sickening chill going down my spine when I heard Ed talking about the possibility of his arrest and imprisonment for being a dissident. I repeat that this recording we're hearing tonight was made about 10 weeks before his arrest, and at the very time that Ed was sitting in his study speaking these words into the microphone, the FBI informer Larry Fairfax was outside the house, creeping around on the Steele property, looking for the stashed silver and adjusting the microphone and the tape recorder under his shirt.
Welcome back to Edgar Steele's Nickel Rant. Now, as I said before the break, I wanted to discuss the police state that is growing in America today for a bit. The seeds for a declaration of martial law already are being spread. Witness the Alabama response recently to that gunman's killing spree with armed military troops openly patrolling city streets. Both Obama and his tax cheat attorney general, Eric Holder, are rushing forward with their plans for gun confiscation. Just this past week, the Department of Defense issued a major shift in policy by declaring that all military surplus expended brass, a major source for those who load their own ammunition, must be demilitarized, which is a euphemism for crushing it down beyond use except as metal to be melted down. What's more, now being floated for public reaction is a list of guns to be banned, a list that includes virtually everything out there except for single-shot 22 caliber rifles, good for nothing more than plinking tin cans. Local police departments hopped up on delusions of Rambo-like grandeur, increasingly think in military terms and act accordingly. The 2008 Defense Authorization Bill actually directed and funded the integration of local police with federal military forces. And more Americans now are in jail than citizens of all other countries are being held in jail combined. Just think about that single fact for a moment. Imagine the boy in the video that I have posted on the web version, the transcript of tonight's Nickel Rant. Go there and look at it. It's not hard to imagine that boy as being your son. Ask yourself if you've ever personally encountered or witnessed a cop with an attitude like that exhibited in the video. Well, I have. Many times. Therefore, I must conclude that almost everybody has. And by the way, the cop merely ended up suspended with pay for a time. Consider just how close to the edge we are in America today. Then stick around and watch the following two videos, the URLs for which I list in the transcript that's posted online following tonight's Nickel Rant. They are videos of our police in action today, in both defenseless white guys in wheelchairs, and in custody, are physically abused by black police officers. Why? Because they can. That's why. This is the way that blacks treat whites when they feel they can get away with it, particularly when they are given official authority. And now we've made one of them our president, thereby further emboldening them. This is your America today. Again, go to the online version of the transcript of tonight's Nickel Rant and look at the videos that I have listed in there. What does all this mean? Since the Bush regime seized power in America, power that continues to be exercised by Obama's minions, for the simple act of writing the very article you are reading or the Nickel Rant that you are listening to right now, current unchallenged law provides that my home can be secretly searched and all my communications secretly monitored without warrants. My home can be broken into in the dead of night and I can be dragged out and held indefinitely. That means permanently, without being charged. I can be strip searched and beaten, all without anybody being told my whereabouts, without access to an attorney, and without ever being given a court hearing. And then I can be shipped out of the country, tortured, tried by a military tribunal, and summarily executed. Seriously, I just have to be named an enemy combatant, which now includes political dissidents, by some faceless bureaucrat. Change you can believe in, indeed. The Police, a rock group, put it really well in their hit song entitled Every Breath You Take. Every move you make, every step you take, I'll be watching you. This could be the motto for the new American now on view at the corner police station. Free speech. Leading Democrats, including the woeful and misbegotten House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, are calling for a crackdown on internet speech, designed to silence critics such as myself. The perennial hate crime bill, again, designed to suppress criticism of so-called minorities, especially blacks and Jews, is wending its way through Congress, provided new impetus by the recent canonization of the deplorable Sir Ted Kennedy. And the Holocaust is being provided ever more strident state support with bills to outlaw criticism of its claims, similar to those extant in Europe, now being formulated in both houses of Congress. Ask yourself why so many in control of America want to jail those who simply disagree with the claim that 6 million Jews systematically were eradicated by the Germans in World War II. We can criticize anything in America these days except things Jewish. Just ask yourself why. Freedom of travel. Under the ATS, Advanced Passenger Information System, already we need permission from Homeland Security to leave or re-enter America, though our passports are in order and we have received valid visas from foreign destinations. This often is done covertly while you wait the boarding call for your jet to wherever. The notification of our airport travel network continues unabated, though precisely zero terrorists have been captured since its inception over 7 years ago. Ask yourself just what is the true intent. Based on results, it has nothing to do with capturing terrorists, because yet it sure has been effective at controlling and tracking law-abiding citizens. Notice how this exactly mirrors the effect of gun control legislation. When air travel is outlawed, only outlaws will have air travel, do you suppose? Travel with more than a couple $1,000 and it will be seized if found, and you will pay hell in getting it back. We're familiar with this scenario, of course. Now, even your home, cash, gold, silver, food stash, is in danger when found by authorities who may legally assume it is theirs unless you can prove you earned it. Logical extension. Can you prove your wife's wedding ring is hers? Can you prove much of anything you possess is yours?
Right, here goes another effort on my part to convince you people to get your asses out here to the Northwest where you're supposed to be. Now, so far, white people have proven to be history's great complainers. Our idea of resistance for the past 60 years has been to constantly analyze, explain, and to state and restate the problem, hoping that someone else will do something about it, or at least someone else will have the guts to state what the solution is. And not that we don't already know what the solution is. We all know, and we've known for some time now, but we're too timid and frightened to even say it, much less do it. Well, in that much at least, your waiting has been rewarded. Here I stand. I will actually say it. And believe it or not, that is actually pretty significant progress. If I had to choose just one accomplishment out of everything I've done since I came home and wrote the first Northwest novel, I would say that I've at least lifted the taboo amongst us against openly discussing genuine change. And from what I see on Drudge Report, I'm not the only one now who's talking the talk. Now, the trick is to find a few good men who are willing to walk the walk. Now, that much hasn't changed yet. Now, the goat dancers say that I have to, quote-unquote, prove my leadership by strapping on a dynamite vest and going out and blowing myself up in a KFC or a Walmart, or else I'm, quote-unquote, a coward and a con man. No, seriously, that's their latest line. I think I'll pass. I'd rather find some way to blow up the dictatorship instead. I love this new country we're going to make more than any of you can understand, but I don't think I'll die for it just quite yet. I'd much rather stick around and see if I can't find some way to make some of these assholes who are listening die for their country. Now, that process begins with a completely lawful act that not even the present dictatorship can prevent anyone from doing, at least not until they introduce a Soviet-style internal passport system. That may not be too far down the pike, but it hasn't happened yet. I myself have already performed this perfectly legal act. I did it 11 years ago. Is that leader enough for you? This perfectly legal and eminently sensible act, which not even the most rabid, frothing-at-the-mouth U.S. attorney or FBI agent in black body armor can stop you from committing, is to come here to the Northwest homeland. To voluntarily give up your American dream and transform your life so that you live by the iron dream. I am tempted to go off on some long, flowery, oratorical flight of fancy right now, but those seem to be of limited effectiveness, so I tell you what. This week, I'm going to go all American on your ass. And I'm going to explain to you guys clearly and precisely why you should start packing the moving van for the Northwest now. I'm not going to give you any racial or political or moral bloviations this week. You don't respond to those. If you did, we'd have had our first 1,000 Class A's out here in the homeland some years ago. No, I'm going to make a naked appeal to pure self-interest. That's the American way. Okay, now I'll begin by assuming a few things about you, the listener. I will assume that your personal and financial situation where you are is not exactly ideal. Wealthy and contented white folks don't listen to programs like this. They're afraid to, because they're terrified that if someone finds out their minds are not under complete control and they think bad thoughts, they will lose what they have. And they most likely would. That's how America controls dissent. America threatens your material wealth. America threatens your social status. America threatens to take these things and make you what they refer to as a loser. And the one thing a white American must never, ever be is a loser. Okay, now you guys listening to this right now may or may not be on the downward spiral where you are. Although, since most whites are on the downward spiral everywhere, this probably does apply to you. But in any case, you're at least worried enough to take the risk of listening to this podcast and having stuff on your hard drive that could get you in a lot of trouble if anybody ever found out that your mind is not completely under control. The bulk of you are probably male, since white males are the ones who are getting the sharpest end of the shaft right now. White females are as well, but they're mostly too dumb to realize what's being done to them. Sorry, ladies, I know there are exceptions, but I have to call things like I see them, and that's how I see it. Now, you white women will eventually realize what's been done to you by this system, by this society, and how every chance that you might have had for happiness has been systematically destroyed by these very people and this very regime that you have been supporting. But when you do, it'll be too late, and your lives will have been forever devastated. Again, I apologize if that offends, but this situation is too critical to allow for anything other than the purest truth. Most likely, you among my predominantly white and male audience fall into one of three categories. You are either an elderly conservative who has been driven almost insane by what you've seen happen to this country over the past three generations. I'm especially looking for men like that who are in a sufficient rage about it that you're actually willing and able to write a man-sized check with some zeros on it if I can get through to you. Now, you guys stick around. I want to talk to you later. I suspect that the majority of my mostly white and male audience consists of middle-aged men in their late 30s or early 40s who have finally woken up to the fact that something's going on in the world and that something is not good. Now, it seems to take white males, on the average, until about the age of 42 for them to look up from the great American consumer trough, sniff the pollution, and realize that something is very badly wrong. I suspect that most of you are in this category, which is good because you're old enough to have a little bit of experience under your belt and yet still have some tread left on the tire, so to speak. Now, the third category of people listening to this are white boys in their teens and 20s, which in this society makes them still children and adolescents, both in general perception and also to some degree in fact. They have never been allowed to grow up. I'm sorry to say it, but that's true. Now, we could really use some kind of catastrophe to make white boys start growing up and becoming men again at the age of 16, like it used to be out on the frontier in the pioneer days. You guys are, of course, the most badly needed. There's no point in my continuing to bloviate on and on here every week to a bunch of old farts and a bunch of dazed and confused middle-aged men who are still not quite fully woken up, and who will probably be elderly by the time they are fully woken up. Now, you kids and you younger guys have one great advantage. You aren't such old dogs that you can't be taught new tricks. You guys can truly live the iron dream if you decide that's what you want. Now, those old farts and those middle-aged men are going to be invaluable to our movement, no question. And I'm certainly not knocking them, and certainly some of them have the intelligence and the character to understand what I'm saying here and do the necessary and make the transition to the iron dream. But the fact is that most of them are read-only discs, if you'll follow my simile. Are you high school and college-age kids and you 20-somethings still living in your parents' basements? You guys are potentially writable, if you get my drift. Sticking with computer terminology, these older men can change their fundamental natures from 4.0 back to an earlier version of 3.0 or 2.5, so to speak, if they make a titanic effort of will. But you younger men haven't been overwritten with so much extra useless or harmful data. Now, the older men have to have their updated versions uninstalled in order to revert to their older versions. But you younger guys can actually be reformatted and the older versions of the software installed from scratch, along with a few special Northwest and National Socialist upgrades. Okay, enough of the software analogy. I agree, that's getting really labored. I tell you what, it's a little early, but how about another modern-day anti-Jewish song? Well, not modern. This is a guy named Frank Gallup from 1966. You couldn't get away with this one today.
The Ballad of Irving. He was short and fat and rode out of the west with a Mogan David on his silver vest. He was mean and nasty right clear through, which was kind of weird because he was yellow too. They called him Irving. Big Irving. Big short Irving. Big short fat Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the west. Irving. He came from the old bar mitzvah spread with a 10-gallon yarmulke on his head. He always followed his mother's wishes. Even on the range, he used two sets of dishes. Irving. Big Fat Irving. Big Sissy Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West.
Irving.
141 could draw faster than he, but Irving was looking for 143. Walked into Saul's saloon like a man insane and ordered 3 fingers of 2 cents plain. Irving. Big Fat Irving. Big Sport Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West.
Irving.
One day, Bad Max happened into town. His aim was to shoot Fat Irving down. Bad Max said, "Draw and draw right now." And Irving drew a picture of a cow. Irving, Big Fat Irving, Big Gunfighter Irving, the 142nd fastest gun in the West. The James Boys was coming on a train at first sun when the town said, "Irving, we need your gun." Well, that train pulled in at the break of dawn. Irving's gun was there, but Irving was gone. Irving. Big Fat Irving. Big Help Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West.
Irving.
Well, finally, Irving got 3 slugs in the belly. It was right outside the Frontier Deli. He was sitting there twirling his gun around, and Butterfingers Irving gunned himself down.
Irving,
Big Fat Irving,
Big Dum Dum Irving,
Big Dum Dum Dead Irving. The 142nd fastest gun in the West. Really?
Okay, I just listened to what I've recorded so far, and I realized that I didn't do what I said I was going to do. But I started rambling off on software analogies. See, this is what happens when I try to ad-lib things. Okay, let's assume that out of laziness or confusion or you ain't the boss of me stupidity, you keep on ignoring me and you don't migrate and you stay where you are and try to muddle through, as Winston Churchill said. Realistically, what is life going to be like for you and your family? Now, let's assume further that you presently still have at least a partly stable and comfortable lifestyle, meaning that you have a job that pays a little more than minimum wage, and you have a place to live, and you have a few toys like a computer and an iPhone and whatnot. If you don't even have those things, then what in God's name is your problem with not migrating right now anyway? Other than, "You're not the boss of me, Harold, and I'm not gonna do what you say, so there, yeah." And yes, I've actually gotten that very attitude from people. Modern-day white people really aren't very bright, you know. Okay, you've got your job and you've got a roof over your head, either rented or some kind of McMansion that has a huge mortgage to be paid off over 30 years, and it's in some part of the country that is filling up with niggers and Mexicans and assorted shit-colored scum like water slowly filling a toilet bowl. But it doesn't matter because you got a job, and you got a place to live, and you got some toys, and you're still at least somewhat young, and we all know things will just magically get better one day, so whoopee! We sometimes forget that the overwhelming majority of people in this country are, in fact, employed. Sort of. But how secure is that job you've got? Are you working for the federal government? Now, if so, you're sitting pretty, but if you're a federal employee, you're probably not listening to this show at all to begin with. You'd be scared to because you know you'll get in trouble if you get caught. Now, you're probably walking into the little booth every 2 years and pulling the lever marked D because you know which side of your bread is buttered. But if, like most white Americans, you actually work in the private sector, then I presume you're intelligent enough to know that very bad things can happen very quickly. Now, how many of us know people, friends, and co-workers, and bowling buddies and whatnot who have been laid off after 10, 15, 20 years of service? Right now, that's happening a lot because of Obamacare, as companies either lay off employees or they cut them to below 30 hours a week so they don't have to pay for their Obamacare. In many cases, they're killing two birds with one stone so the company can make way for younger people who can fill diversity quotas and who will work for a lot less and who don't know where all the bodies are buried. You need to start thinking about the future. I know that's another thing that white people are socially engineered not to do. We're supposed to constantly be living in quote-unquote real time, an eternal present. But we need to relearn that faculty of looking ahead in years, not just 10 minutes ahead. Now, I want you to wrap your minds around something. Whatever you have now in Houston or Jacksonville or Jersey or Ohio or Arizona will not last. Not if the long, slow decay continues, and not if the balloon goes up. Now, unless you are a federal government employee, it is a virtual certainty that you are going to find yourself unemployed in your late 40s or early 50s and completely unable to find comparable work again because of the racial and age discrimination against white people and white males in particular. You know, it's no coincidence that some media refer to the current so-called recession as the man-cession. The new normal overall unemployment rate may be 10%, but the unemployment rate for middle-aged white males is much higher. Nobody knows how high, because we haven't been allowed to know the true employment statistics for some years now. But you need to understand that what happened to me is almost certainly going to happen to you. Right about the time your body starts to decay and you need to access your company health benefits, there is a very high likelihood, almost a certainty, that you are going to lose those benefits and get thrown into Obamacare, which you will have to pay for yourself at ruinous expense, and which will provide sloppy, substandard, niggerized service, just like socialized medicine throughout the world provides. I want you to sit down and think very carefully about what it's going to be like to find yourself in that situation, most likely in a world that is even more cruel and dangerous than today in 2013. You will have no job. You will have little or no income except for some kind of welfare check or food stamps, maybe. You are starting to get sick. You are starting to get old. And you have no health insurance except for the insanely expensive Obamacare, which the government forces you to buy, which provides substandard, niggerized health care barely one cut above leeches and voodoo. This is going to happen to you. I know it. And you know it too. If you were sufficiently secure not to have to worry about this happening, then you wouldn't be listening to this podcast. You're listening to me right now because you know that something is terribly, terribly wrong. And you know it because something is wrong in your own lives. And you can see that every day. You know that there is a monster out there in the dark. And as the years go by and the little circle of light around your campfire gets smaller and dimmer, then the monster will suddenly be on top of you, biting and tearing your flesh with its fangs and claws. You know that one day it's going to be your turn. You know that you can wallow in the mud and keep your snout in the slop trough for a while, but one day, probably when you're starting to get old and too weak and timid to even try to fight, the black or brown farmer will come with his axe, and it will be you that he drags screaming and squealing to the slaughterhouse floor, because it's your turn now, white boy. You've had your slop. Now it's time for you to pay the price. Now it's time for you to feed us like you're supposed to. You have gorged on the glorious slop of America for long enough, and now it is time for your throat to be slit and your blood to flow. You know this is going to happen. You wouldn't be listening otherwise. So why in God's name will you not come here to where there are others like you? You can't hide from your enemies who will be destroying you in a few years' time. Why do you hide from your friends? Oh, I forgot. You're not the boss of me. What about your family? Most likely that's been broken up by the stresses and strains of America, true, but many of you do still have children or old people that you're still at least partly responsible for. Is it really such a favor to them to make them face the world that will exist in this country in 20 years' time, surrounded by niggers or Mexicans or Somalis or faggots or drug pushers and addicts? What kind of parent really doesn't care if their children grow up in a garden of poison because it's just too much risk and effort to take them to a better place, one of the best remaining places left to live in the world? What if the balloon really does go up and some kind of catastrophic event makes it impossible to migrate because there's no more gasoline or diesel fuel? And all of a sudden, you're stuck in your McMansion or in your ticky-tacky apartment or in your double-wide, and you are literally physically surrounded by black and brown shitskins who want what you have. And there's no more 9/11 to call. And you let the regime take your guns all those years ago because otherwise you might have gotten in trouble. And then all of a sudden there you are, in your 50s and 60s, all alone, unarmed and defenseless, one of a few white specks in a sea of black and brown in some hellhole city, or else one of the few remaining people in some small town where all the young people have fled and the delivery trucks for the grocery stores stopped coming a few weeks ago. This is what's going to happen, guys. And then there's the nursing home scenario. That's one of my favorites. When will the police finally come for you under some federal senior citizens law and take you away to some state-run nursing home to be quote-unquote cared for by Nigerians and Filipinos and Arabs when you're 65, 75, whatever the mandatory age is? What's it going to be like on that cold, dark morning when you wake up and you find Muhammad the orderly or Dr. Singh with the turban standing over you with a hypodermic needle in their hand? Do you understand? Do you grasp that the way things are going, it is almost certain that this is how things will end for you personally? Never mind the white race, never mind Western civilization. You're Americans. You don't care about that. All you care about is yourselves. I get that, but do you understand that this is what will most likely happen to you personally? Why in God's name will you not come here and prevent that? Okay, this is from that stupid movie Borat, the one where the Jew comedian Sacha Baron Cohen plays pranks on Gentiles. He got up at a karaoke someplace in America and started singing an anti-Jewish song and got everybody singing. Now, he thought he was making a point about American anti-Semitism, and he was, just not the point he thought he was making. I want you to sit down now, and I want you to think about the future. Your future. Think of yourselves as Ebenezer Scrooge. Through this program, and otherwise, you've already received your visits from the Ghost of Christmas Past and the Ghost of Christmas Present. Now it's time for the Ghost of Christmas Future to appear, the one whom Scrooge said he feared most of all. as will you if you have any sense. Now, I'm dead serious about this. I want you to sit down and think about what it's going to be like to die in that nursing home at age 85, or lying on the floor of your own home, where the last thing you see and feel are big, black, stinking, nappy-headed niggers screaming filthy words out of their bubble lips and beating you and beating you, demanding you give them money that you no longer have. Or don't even think that far ahead. Think about where you and your life and your family, if any, are going to be in 10, 15, 20 years' time. If you're young, will Obama's America ever even allow you to have a family? How are you going to get married and qualify for a mortgage on a home in a physically safe neighborhood if you're still delivering pizzas or working at the Blockbuster at age 35? If you've already had a family and America took them away from you, will you ever be allowed to start over and make a new one? Don't count on it. That's a common illusion, but real life isn't like TV. A man can't support two families, the new and the old, unless he has a very good job and a very high income indeed. Do you think that's ever going to happen to you? Forget the horse manure you see on TV and in the movies. In real life, do you think you will ever be allowed to start over? Now, it used to be true, and one of the most proud and glorious things that this country could boast of, that America offered one thing that no other place on earth offered, and that was an endless supply of fresh starts. That's not true anymore. And if you don't know that, you're damn sure going to find out. And it's only going to get worse. Any fresh starting you're planning on, you need to get on with it now. You need to start planning your migration for real, and you need to do it within the next year, because we simply don't know what's going to happen. It may be just a long and endless rotting away, like I said a few weeks ago. But on the other hand, we may turn on CNN tomorrow and see that Benny has launched the bombers against Tehran. We just don't know, and you need to quit screwing around and do this thing, because tomorrow may literally be too late. Okay, let's be American about this. Don't do it for me. Don't do it for your race. Don't even do it for your children's future. Do it because it's the best thing for you to do. Do it because it just plain doesn't make sense to let yourself grow old and unemployed in middle age in some hideous eastern city where you will be an old white man surrounded by black and brown beasts who want to take what little you have left and who will hurt you and make you suffer out of sheer blind animal race hatred. Or in some small town where the goods and services you will need will simply dry up and which will become uninhabitable. Why are you letting that happen to you, you damn fool? Get your ass out here to the Northwest where you can get some help when you need it. Or at least you'll be able to as soon as all you damn fools get your asses out here. Now, if you won't listen to me, listen to your own self-interest. That's the American way. Our time is up now, so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98104. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.
Still is beating her.